This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, March 12th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. KUAF is supported by the fully remodeled and expanded Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m., including Sundays. 277-8493 or facebook.com/Walmart Museum for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, with the passage of the private option in the rearview mirror, political pundits are shifting their attention to primary races and the Mark Pryor-Tom Cotton U.S. Senate matchup. Roby Brock from our content partner moderates a roundtable discussion that addresses these topics. Also, researchers discuss their plans for assessing the environmental impacts of a hog farm operating in the Buffalo River watershed.
And in the latest installment of our monthly Three Things series, we learn three benefits to participating in a student exchange program. Also, we dig through our archives as we remember Washington County Election Commissioner John Logan Burrow. He passed away earlier this week.
Those stories and more, but first, legislators in Arkansas are approaching adjournment. Yesterday, both chambers passed identical budget bills by overwhelming margins. Today, the House and Senate are expected to approve each other's budgets, essentially completing the tasks required for the fiscal session. The bills nudge the state's budget over $5 billion for the next fiscal year, an increase of about 2% over the current state budget.
Former Arkansas Treasurer Martha Shoffner faces up to 20 years in prison after being found guilty on all 14 counts of bribery and extortion. Shoffner was accused of taking more than $35,000 from a bond broker in exchange for directing state business toward the broker. The trial began last week and went to the jury yesterday. Shoffner could be sentenced to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000. She also faces multiple counts of wire fraud in a separate trial.
The U.S. Marshals Museum will use a six-figure grant to host a lecture series in the future. The $100,000 grant was made by Lisson Rockefeller, the widow of former Arkansas Lieutenant Governor Winthrop Paul Rockefeller. Jessica Hayes, the museum's vice president of operations, says the lecture series will extend the museum's mission of education.
The Marshal Service is really unique in that it is one of the only federal agencies that's attached to all three branches of government. And that really interesting and unique relationship provides a lot of opportunities for public programs. So just in conversations around the office and with some of our board members, we sort of latched on to this idea of doing a formal lecture series that would explore each of those relationships.
Hayes says museum officials hope to attract speakers such as Supreme Court justices to Fort Smith for the lecture series. The lectures would take place annually. Groundbreaking for the museum is scheduled for September. Hayes says the staff can see an example of what a museum can mean for a city in Little Rock.
I think the Clinton Library is a perfect example of the type of relationship that a museum can have with the community, with the state as well, and also sort of that symbiotic relationship and the way that one benefits the other.
The series will be officially named the Winthrop Paul Rockefeller Distinguished Lecture Series.
A sales tax in Alma that's been on the books since 1998 appears to be ending. Voters in the city yesterday rejected an extension of the 1% sales tax that was to be used in the future for capital improvements in that city. Fewer than 10% of the city's registered voters cast ballots in the special election. Final but not official totals indicate the tax was defeated 121 to 104.
The University of Arkansas is expanding its explanation about the goal to become a top 50 research university. The U of A has developed a website devoted to the goal that was first announced in 2012 by Chancellor David Gerhardt. The university says the new site explores ways the school's efforts toward that goal have improved academics and research on campus. It also explains the guidelines to becoming a top 50 research university. U.S. News and World Report currently places the University of Arkansas as the 63rd ranked public institution research university.
The Bentonville Public School District continues its process to name a new high school and pick a mascot for the school. The district's second high school, to be constructed in Centerton, was approved by voters last fall and is expected to be completed in 2016. The school has not been officially named yet, though a survey of current 8th and 9th graders included suggestions like Bentonville West and Benton County High. Mary Lay, the district's director of communications, says Alliance High School is another possibility.
A freshman student came to me with that, and I thought he would, as a student, he was thinking larger than himself, and I think that's very admirable. And he told me that it's so important for, because this has been a controversial building to come forth, and he wanted his community to come together. He wanted students to always come together and people to work together. And he thinks that should start in a high school.
She says the selection of the name will come from a list of possibilities submitted by students and members of the community and ranked by each of the 7 members of the school board.
Out of the 21, they have suggested I have to narrow it down to the top 3, whatever was the majority of the top 3. And then those 3 will, the name and the mascot, will go back. They've chosen the 8th grade and the 7th grade because those would be the 2 classes that will enter the new high school right away. And so that's about 2,100 students, then we'll vote on those 3, and then I'm to submit that to the board, their results Monday night.
Mascot suggestions have included Wolverines, Thunderbolts, and Chargers, though no mascot has been an overwhelming favorite among students polled.
Several area organizations are being recognized by the Arkansas Governor's Conference on Tourism for work related to the tourism industry. The conference wrapped up last night in Rogers with an annual awards ceremony. The Fort Smith Visitors and Convention Bureau was given the award for community tourism development, while the Rogers Frisco Festival was given an award highlighting an established event held in the state. Alice Walton, the founder of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, was named Arkansas's Tourism Person of the Year, and the public radio program Tales from the South earned the conference's Media Support Award.
A rally outside the state capitol yesterday is likely to be repeated in the future. The gathering is dubbed Truthful Tuesday and was led by 6th Judicial Circuit Court Judge Wendell Griffin. The judge says the movement seeks to raise awareness and discussion about topics including a potential minimum wage hike and new voter ID laws in the state. The Truthful Tuesday rallies are inspired by a similar effort in North Carolina called Moral Mondays. Organizers of the Arkansas event say they plan to meet weekly.
The University of Arkansas softball team will try to improve on its 19-5 record this evening in Tulsa. Arkansas faces the Golden Hurricane for its first road game since late February. Arkansas has won 4 consecutive games and 17 of its last 19. Arkansas returns home for a 3-game series against Tennessee this weekend.
Forecast calls for mostly clear skies tonight, with overnight lows in the upper 20s in northwest Arkansas and mid-30s in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Thursday, sunny conditions with highs between 62 and 66. Thursday evening, mostly clear with lows around 32 in northwest Arkansas and dropping to near 40 in the Arkansas River Valley.
There are plenty of Arkansas politics to discuss this week, from the private option to the political primaries to the Mark Pryor-Tom Cotton U.S. Senate matchup. This past weekend on KATV's Talk Business and Politics, Roby Brock and KATV lead Capitol reporter Janelle Lilly discussed these topics with political columnist John Brummett and Political Animals Club president Rex Nelson. Now that the private option has passed, Roby asked John Brummett, what was the reaction from the opponents to the private option? How did they handle the bill's passage?
Sort of resignation. They, like everyone else, figured it was going to pass eventually. And sort of, they're waiting to say, they told us so. They're waiting to say, well, this thing is just going to be more expensive. Now we're going to see that the budget is made, that there's going to be a great run on money. And lo and behold, the next day, $92 million in surplus funds they tried to spend. Just sort of a, we'll wait and see, that this is going to be the most horrible mess you've ever seen, and you'll be sorry.
That's, and some of the people that voted for it are in that camp as well. I mean, that was the essence of Kim Hammer's speech for the bill, was that he's waiting for something to go wrong.
Yeah, Rex. I don't think it is a coincidence that we finally passed this thing right when the filing period was closing.
Exactly.
You know, and a lot of us may have seen that coming early, and that a lot of people were worried, on the Republican side certainly, with primary competition, somebody coming at them from their right. And once that filing period is over, once they know they don't have that primary opponent, then it becomes a lot easier.
I thought the most interesting thing was after the vote, John Selig asked him about their enrollment targets. You're going to try to get a lot of people enrolled by July 1 before the Nate Bell Amendment takes effect. He essentially said the Nate Bell Amendment was ineffectual. He said, we don't do that much direct promotion anyway. This is all word of mouth. This is through churches. We expect by the time we sit here next year at this time, we'll have full enrollment of the full 250,000 people, which means it's going to be very difficult for a new governor and a new legislature of any party, of any persuasion, to undo it at that time.
The navigators are the big thing that the Nate Bell Amendment
impacts. Of course, earlier there was a huge advertising campaign plan that was pulled back.
Well, they just couldn't get the funding for it.
Right.
Let's talk about how this plays out in the political primaries now. As you indicated, the candidate filing period has closed. The action is on the GOP side. I think we've got a graphic here to just kind of show how some of this plays out here. When you look at the races here, the federal races, the statewide races, the state Senate, the Arkansas House, there's 18 contested primaries on the GOP side, only 4 on the Democratic side. One of those is the governor's race. So you got no action on the Democratic side. How does the private option and how does that lineup that I just presented there, Rex, play out in the primaries?
You know, this is, we've done a 180 from the Arkansas that John Brummett and I grew up in. Of course, that was a long time ago when John Brummett and I grew up. But, for decades, though, you know, all the action was in the Democratic primary, the old Tanamount, too. Now you look at these numbers and you see, I think the total was like 132 Republicans that filed for state and federal offices, only 88 Democrats filed for state and federal offices. This is not the Arkansas that a lot of us knew, and it's all happened since the 2010 election cycle. I mean, whether you're a Democrat, an independent, or a Republican, you've got to admit we're living in a very historic time in Arkansas politics. We're seeing a transformation that I think is going to last for decades.
The issue is whether we're having more Republican primaries simply because the Republican nomination is now the big thing to have. The Republican Party is the one that's in charge, it's vibrant. Or is this a proliferation of specific battles over the private option? That'll be interesting to see. Some of the races, we know the people are challenging incumbents on that basis. It'll be interesting to see Missy Irwin's race, how John Burris does for the open Senate race with somebody opposing him. And the activity of this group, Conduit for America, which was formed, it's not the Koch brothers, it's to the right of the Koch brothers.
Right.
And they were very much against the private option. So I think it's a combination. The Republican Party is where it's at. We're in the middle of a Republican revolution, so their primary is attracts more people, but the subtext, which may be the main text, is the private option.
Let's talk about the Democratic primary, Janelle, because Mike Ross has a primary opponent now, and I think this has some interesting ramifications here. I think you're the only reporter who's interviewed his Democratic opponent, Lynette Bryant. Why did she get in?
She actually got in for an unusual reason. It surprised me. It's because she's a big Mark Pryor supporter. And she believes that by Mike Ross vacating his seat, he allowed someone else like Tom Cotton to come into Ascension, get the attention that he has on the national stage, and be a real challenger for Mark Pryor's seat. She felt that Mike Ross, if he wanted to be governor, he should have stayed where he was and then ascended that way, and she felt that it was irresponsible on his behalf.
So with this low Democratic primary in terms of turnout here, I think you got so many uncontested races that it's going to be a low Democratic primary turnout, maybe the lowest we've ever seen in history. Mike Ross has to win by a convincing margin, I think, or else he looks weak going into the general election. Does that match up against Lynette Bryant? I don't think he loses, but could it play?
I think he wins convincingly.
But what is convincing? Bill Clinton beat Monroe Swerslow 69-31 in such a situation in 1980, and everybody said, "Oh, he's finished. If he could only beat that guy by 30." How do you define success? How much does he beat Ms. Bryant by. That's interesting that she's running to, she's mad at him, to spite him for...
She just felt that she could no longer vote for him. She felt that, you know, in some ways he had betrayed the party.
I have been at Democratic functions and had the opportunity to meet her. She's very impressive. Very impressive woman.
I felt the same way.
I mean, she's a major Hillary supporter.
And
major.
She came up with the filing fee,
so,
too.
Right. So, John, where do the, in a primary, where do the anti-Ross votes come from? From the left of him? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes. Yes. And that's, in other words, we're dealing with a small
group.
But sort of disaffected liberals who can't stand this whole Democratic theme of to get elected by being Republican light, and who will want to cast a vote for, and maybe some African-American votes, which also are those to the left as well. That's the question. Mm-hmm. What is his target? How much does he need to win by to avoid the appearance of being weakened?
Well, there'll be some comparison to how well Asa Hutchinson does in his primary against Curtis mm-hmm. Coleman, too, so those comparisons are going to be invited. Janelle, you kind of framed the debate for us. Mark Pryor, Tom Cotton, I think it's easy to say they had a skirmish this week. I could even use the military reference there.
You could use the military reference, and I do have the quote with me. Mark Pryor, when asked a question about Tom Cotton's military service and whether or not he feels that that is a good launching ground mm-hmm. for his run for Senate, he answered back and said, I think that's part of the sense of entitlement that he gives off. It's almost like I served my country, therefore let me into the Senate.
Was he talking about Cotton's qualifications for the Senate, or was he talking about his military qualifications? You've diced and sliced this thing.
Doesn't require much dice and slice. He's not critiquing Mr. Cotton as a soldier. He's not talking about his performance in the military. He is not dismissing or disparaging, obviously. In fact, to the contrary, he said, I have great respect. Of course, he is saying, if this is the sole, and that was because of the framing of the question, because he had said this guy hadn't done anything in his time in Congress. And then the reporter said, well, what about the military as a commendation for the office? And he's saying that alone does not qualify one for the Senate, just as Tom Cotton had said Chuck Hagel's military record didn't qualify him to be defense secretary. That's all he said, but he used that word, entitlement. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a red flag to all the anti-spending conservatives. Yep. Well, somehow we've got Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and probably the private option and food stamps and WIC and all of that messed up in this deal because he used this word entitlement. They keep coming back, entitlement. He simply used a word that's sort of a flashpoint in political debate.
Did Pryor step in it, or did Pryor just could have handled it a little bit better?
You know, they wanted this grand narrative of this guy. Yes, he grew up in Arkansas, but he's been gone for years. He parachuted in here, uses outside money. Now he's trying to grab one of our two Senate seats, and they hadn't had that much luck with that so far. So I think that Senator Pryor had to turn up the heat to try to get that narrative rolling a little more, and that's what he was attempting to do with these comments. And they may have indeed backfired.
Yeah, I think, like you said, the issue was with the word entitlement, which of course is an emotive word. You know, as a journalist, I truly try to stay away from assuming I know what other people's feelings are. I mean, you can certainly recognize joy and grief, but other than that, it's very difficult. You go from basically giving your own opinion to giving the opinion of another person when you use emotive words.
I think that we're going to see a lot of these skirmishes, though. This is going to be about a week.
This one will be long since forgotten, and we're going to have these bi-weekly, fortnightly.
It's going to give John plenty of columns. He's going to love it. Easy. More time on the tennis courts this summer, John. Easy columns.
It's fascinating to watch these partisans in this hyper environment we've got. Pounce. I mean, hey, we got Mark Pryor saying entitlement in reference to military service. Let's go.
You've got to be cautious as a journalist on that.
Right.
Yeah. But, so I will not put Janelle on the spot on this because she's an impartial, objective news reporter here.
And we aren't.
And you guys aren't. So where do you sense the Cotton Pryor race is today? Who has the advantage today?
You want to go first? Advantage Cotton. Yeah. Let's be serious. The Republican mm-hmm. revolution proceeds apace. It's all about Obama and Obamacare. Pryor's for it. Even when Pryor says something innocent, he's getting beaten up over it. Whereas Mike Ross can maybe localize the governor's race and do better. Right now, it's a nationalized race. Advantage Cotton pretty clearly. Pryor's task is not just to say he's an outsider, Cotton, but that he's kind of an oddball extremist. That's the case he has to make. Mm-hmm. But the only guy who's buying that I can see is me and a couple other people. Nobody's out there worried about this frightful Tom Cotton. For all the things I've written that they need to be, I don't see that penetrating yet.
I agree, advantage Cotton. That's not to say it's not a winnable race for Senator Pryor, but if he does win, I think it'll be one of the great political victories in modern Arkansas history, because he will have done it swimming against this tremendous red tide that's been Absolutely. Washing over Arkansas since 2010.
If you have Barack Obama and Obamacare around your neck and you win, that's a heroic political
He's
accomplishment.
In the top five,
but
yeah,
he hasn't done it. He hasn't done it.
That was Roby Brock and KATV lead Capitol reporter Janelle Lilly speaking to political columnist John Brummett and Political Animals Club president Rex Nelson on KATV's Talk Business and Politics. The show can be seen in the Central Arkansas Market at 9 Sunday mornings on KATV. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. I brought in Roger Plourd, the Ozark Blues Society president. He talks about the 2014 Blues in the Natural State, happening April 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Headlining the festival this year, Tab Benoit, Royal Southern Brotherhood, featuring Devin Allman, Cyril Neville, and Mike Zito, Samantha Fish, the Cape Brothers, RJ Michaud, and more. Hear about it this Friday night on the Generic Blues Show. We'll see you then.
Last week, Secretary of State John Kerry offered commendation to schools across the country who support public diplomacy efforts by hosting high school exchange students. Huntsville High School was among those Arkansas schools praised for participating in student exchange programs, which can benefit both local and visiting students.
They learn a great deal about the other person's culture and also learn to respect that person from another culture as a human being, and see, you know, by knowing them well and becoming friends with them, they learn a lot of the value that that person and their culture has to offer, as well as finding out that in many ways they're just not that much different than we are.
We'll have more on that story in the second half of Ozarks at Large.
The Big Creek Research and Extension Team is a partnership among environmental and agricultural researchers and a number of state and federal agencies. The group was called together last year by the Arkansas Legislature to study potential environmental impacts of the C&H hog farm that began operating in the Buffalo River watershed. Yesterday, the research team presented details of its first quarterly report on the University of Arkansas campus. As Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, the seminar was more about how the group is conducting its research than drawing firm conclusions.
Nathan McKinney, assistant director of the Arkansas Agricultural Experiment Station, introduced yesterday's seminar. As a member of the Big Creek research team, he explained the job the team was given when it was formed in July of last year.
We were tasked with investigating the management of nutrients on the C&H farm in Newton County in the Big Creek watershed. Our team has been working furiously the last 7 months, and we believe it was the proper time now to address our colleagues here on campus and the general public.
Essentially, yesterday's seminar centered around what the team has been doing and what it plans to do as research continues in Newton County. Leading the Big Creek researchers is Andrew Sharpley, a professor of crop, soil, and environmental sciences. He says that the team's genesis really came when the owner of C&H Hog Farm asked the extension agent in Newton County for help.
help in addressing some of the concerns that he was hearing. And so as he went to Extension, that brought us, as the Division of Ag, into the frame. And so we were asked by the state, the legislature, to develop a research plan, which we did and submitted. And basically, that's where we are at the moment.
The multidisciplinary team includes hydrologists, microbiologists, stream ecologists, and other specialists. It also has support from several partners, including the U.S. Geological Survey, the USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the state legislature. Sharpley says that the team is also partnering with the National Park Service.
We know that they are monitoring sites, other places downstream of Big Creek from where this farm is. So we have talked with them. We will communicate together so that we're measuring the same things in the same way, so that we have a comprehensive database. They're going to be monitoring more on the park operations, but it's no use us working in a vacuum and just keeping this to ourselves.
With the range of specializations and resources available to the team, Sharpley says that the researchers are trying to take a multidisciplinary look at the contentious issue of a hog farm operating in the Buffalo River watershed, specifically asking the question, are the management practices of the farm sustainable?
And we're monitoring the fate and transport of the nutrients and bacteria that might be applied through the slurry, and what the fate of transport once is applied to those fields. We want to look at the, assess what those applications might be on surrounding waters, whether it's stream, groundwater, springs, ephemeral streams within the farm and adjacent to the farm.
The team is conducting its research on three fields adjacent to Big Creek.
We have access to the farm, access to the fields that are going to be applied to. So we're looking at it from a farm, a larger scale, and also at the watershed scale. So we're trying to take this large compass of from a small to the large scale. And so we're looking at source management of those fields, of those that are permitted, the sustainable operation, as I've mentioned, and also the impact on the water quality, either in that stream, downstream, when it reaches the buffalo, what is the also the quality of other streams in this watershed at the same time.
Two of the three fields on which researchers are focusing will actually have hog manure applied, while one of the fields won't have any hog manure from the CNH hog farm. However, the unfertilized field will serve as a control field where researchers can get baseline data to compare to the fields that will be fertilized. But what exactly will researchers be doing on these fields?
First thing is we're doing a topographic survey. And that may not mean much to some of you, but a LIDAR basically tells you where the slopes are in that field. If you go out there now, there's a bit of grass growth. The grass is probably fairly even. You can't see where the slopes are.
Sharpley explains, perhaps obviously, the significance of knowing the precise topography of the fields.
From this LIDAR in Big Creek, we can do from this centimeter on a point grid, we can then go back and we have models that will tell us fairly easily where water is going to flow, knowing these different slopes. You know, water is going to go downhill, so it's not that complicated a model, to be honest. So it knows where there's a slope. And this is what it does. Basically, these are little sub-watersheds within this field of about 20 acres.
Knowing where the water flows over the surface is crucial to the research team in that it lets them know where they need to put their measuring equipment to get a more accurate picture of how water and nutrients will flow over the field surfaces. To find out how water will flow below the ground, researchers are using ground-penetrating radar.
We can't keep digging holes in fields to assess what's down there, because then we've created a bypass flow, or we've created a hole for water and nutrients to move through. So NRCS have this technology, ground penetrating radar. Radar goes into the ground when it senses a difference in the layers underneath there. It gives us a 3D map of what's below the ground. And so we've done that to try and help us determine better what's underneath those fields to better determine where to put our implementations and our monitoring.
The radar imagery gives researchers a patterned image showing layers of soil and rock, thus allowing them to draw conclusions about the subterranean geological composition. Recent wet weather has prevented the researchers from conducting more radar scans of the fields, as the heavy equipment would compact the soggy ground and thus create additional problems with taking measurements. All of that high-tech data tells the research team where the water is flowing, guiding the Big Creek researchers where to actually monitor nutrient concentrations. And Sharpley says that researchers are using a quarter-acre grid to sample the nutrient concentrations in the soil.
On this grid, we collected samples down to as far as we could go. Sometimes we got down to about 3 feet. Sometimes we could get down to 6 feet. And so we've analyzed those for phosphorus, nitrogen, different calcium, potassium, all sorts of things that we can measure from those soil samples. We got those done at the State Soil Test Lab down in Mariana. So a lot of soil samples.
So many samples, in fact, when combined with the variable rocky terrain, only two of the fields have been sampled as of this first quarterly report. But monitoring the sustainability of the fields, or how much hog manure they can actually handle, is only one aspect of the Big Creek research team's work. Another aspect involves assessing the water quality of Big Creek as the manure is applied to these fields. Sharpley explains how the team is measuring the creek's water quality.
We've been collecting weekly samples from above and below the farm on Big Creek, and we've been measuring nutrients and sediment and bacteria in an A-certified lab. We bring those samples back and analyze them within 24 hours. So we've been taking these samples midweek. Again, we don't want to inconvenience the lab, and we take them on Friday. They've got to do work on Saturday, but we've got a time limit of 24 hours where you've got to get that initial analysis started. You've got to get that sample filtered. You've got to get the dirt or the sediment out of it, because things will change, and it won't represent what's in the stream. You've got to get that bacteria plated, as I say, within 8 hours.
He says that those stringent testing standards put forth by the Environmental Protection Agency mean that the data collected will stand up to scientific scrutiny. In addition to sampling the water quality in the creek itself, Sharpley says the team is also sampling water quality and runoff from the fields and in an ephemeral stream and at least one spring in the area.
We know that water is obviously, if it's not running off, it's going down, so we've found a few streams. Springs, we know they're all over the place. We'll hope we'll find more, but we're going to monitor a spring that's near one of the application fields and look to see if it's moving down and we can monitor it in that spring.
In addition to collecting base flow samples, Sharpley says the team is also collecting samples during stormwater runoff events. If that sounds like a lot of talk about how the team is collecting their data, then you're right. As this is the team's first quarterly report, most of the researchers' data is preliminary, and more monitoring will be necessary to actually draw conclusions on the impacts to water quality caused by the nearby CNH hog farm. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
To find the full report, go to uaex.edu and search for Big Creek Research and Extension Team Quarterly Report.
It is Wednesday, March 12th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor, Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Not that I'm bitter or anything, but some people still get spring break.
Some people do, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we should talk about some of the classes and fun activities that will be offered from the 22nd to the 28th.
Okay.
At Crystal Bridges, every day. Something every day.
Okay.
They're doing spring bingo. You pick up a bingo card in the lobby, complete your bingo hunt, and stop back in the lobby to pick up a prize. They're also doing string painting, family tours, and on the 22nd, a presentation of Stella Luna by Stone Lion Puppet Theater. Sounds like fun to me. Also drop-in drawing and other sorts of things all week. Check their website at crystalbridges.org. Trike Theater is doing a spring break camp. Themes are Puppet Masters on the 26th, Mad Scientists on the 27th, and Not a Box Players on the 28th. And you can find out more about that at 464-5084. Hobbs State Park is doing a spring break camp that includes hiking and games and live animals if it's not snowing. Okay, I'm cynical. March 26th through 28th. You can find out more about that at 789-5000. And tomorrow we'll do the Washington County spring break events.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm Margaret Jundwaite. Join me for Werther, Massenet's sublime depiction of impossible love. Werther, Saturday, live on the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera International Radio Network.
Listen Saturday at noon to 91.3 FM. You can also see this week's opera live in HD at the Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville. For two free tickets to that screening, search Facebook for Of Note with Katie Henriksen or call 575-5823.
AFS USA is a nonprofit organization that offers international exchange programs in more than 40 countries. The group has been exchanging students throughout the world for more than 65 years. According to a press release from the organization, last week, Secretary of State John Kerry issued a communication to exceptional U.S. schools that support public diplomacy efforts by hosting high school exchange students sponsored by the U.S. Department of State. Some of the Arkansas schools that received this commendation include Rogers Heritage High School and Huntsville High School. Anna Chapel, a counselor at Huntsville High School, says the school has hosted exchange students for a number of years, and they found it provides a tremendous advantage for both local and visiting students.
Because they learn a great deal about the other person's culture and also learn to respect that person from another culture as a human being and see, you know, by knowing them well and becoming friends with them, they learn a lot of the value that that person and their culture has to offer, as well as finding out that in many ways they're just not that much different than we are.
Chapel says the school hosts 2 to 3 students each year, and the kids hail from a variety of countries, including Germany, Japan, Austria, and Thailand. Typically, the students are 16 to 18 years old, and Chapel says some come during their junior year so they can return to their home country to complete their senior year. However, others travel to the U.S. following their senior year, so Huntsville High School allows them to complete a second senior year here in the States. In addition to helping these foreign exchange students, Chapel and her family have actually hosted a couple of them.
We had fortunately had friends over the years that had hosted exchange students before we did, and we felt like it was just a wonderful opportunity for those families. My children got to know the exchange students, you know, because we were friends with their host families, and just really wanted to try it. So the first thing we tried was a short-term exchange where we had a girl from Peru come and live with us for about one quarter of the school year, which was, you know, shorter than most exchanges, but it can be worked out that way. And that's what she wanted, and we were happy to do it. And the high school was very cooperative then with us working that out. And then we thought, you know, that went so well. We have tried, you know, other times. We've actually hosted a girl from Peru, a girl from Japan, a boy from Japan, and a girl from Brazil.
Chapel has hosted students for a number of reasons. When asked for 3 benefits of participating in the exchange program, she said it's tough to limit it to just 3.
Well, one of the benefits is definitely that you add another absolutely wonderful person to your family. And I will tell you, once they live with you for a while, you really have a hard time letting go of them. And so it's just like adopting a child. I hear pretty regularly from some of those 4 we've had in the past. Another benefit I would think would just be perspective, because we all have to realize that we can't be little turtles here in America anymore and that we have to fully be aware of and participate in the world as a whole. And I think that's still a hard concept for children to learn and for a lot of adults. So I think that that's another advantage, is that it makes you think more about the world as one unit and all those different people as valuable and having special things to offer.
Another benefit for Chapel has been her own education.
I've learned a lot of different things to cook, and I've learned about cultural issues, art, manners, things like that, and different things that are appropriate within different cultures. And I think, in a way, that's been good as far as helping the folks in my family realize that sometimes people don't see us the way we think they do, and that, you know, you need to be attuned to how other people and other cultures are receiving you. And it's all worked out very positively, but there have been a few times where we've had to regroup and sit down and talk about something because it was obvious that their reaction was not what we meant.
For interested parties who may be concerned about participating because they aren't exceedingly wealthy, Chapel says hosting a student is not a large financial burden.
The student, you know, of course, pays the exchange program a number of fees for different things. They come here with their own insurance. They are supposed to provide their own spending money and, you know, take care of things like that. So, you know, you're not worrying about burdening your family with having to come up with a lot of extra money for supporting another child. You are expected to provide, you know, a bed and laundry and, you know, feed them at the family table and things like that. And that does alter the grocery bill a little bit, I found, especially with teenage boys. But it's very reasonable as far as the financial obligations. And I think that that would matter to a lot of people because, you know, money's just tight for most folks. And, you know, when you look at trying to provide everything that goes into, you know, having a student in high school, that can get pretty expensive.
For those interested in hosting a student, Anna Chapel, a counselor at Huntsville High School, says they can contact her, and she would be glad to share the contact information for the different organizations they've worked with in the past. In addition to AFS USA, that list also includes Academic Year in America and Cultural Academic Student Exchange. For more, you can contact Huntsville High School at 738-2500. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Last week, the Springdale Police Department released the results of its amnesty and food drive event that they organized in February. Individuals could turn themselves in on nonviolent warrants and have their bond waived in exchange for a food donation. The department served 97 warrants and collected nearly 300 non-perishable food items, or approximately 250 pounds of food. Springdale Police Department donated the food to Wooten's Helping Hands at Harbor High School. This is a food bank that was set up by SPD Officer Tommy Wooten in partnership with HBHS students and staff. It is designed to provide food for less fortunate students in the district.
The Free Extraction Day, sponsored by the Dental Hygiene Clinic at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith, has been rescheduled for Saturday. The event, which was originally planned for December and canceled due to inclement weather, allows members of the Fort Smith community to have a tooth pulled for free. Hours are 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the clinic, which is located in the Pendergraft Health Sciences Center on Waldron Road. Patients will be seen on a first-come, first-served basis and should bring a list of medications they are taking. The event's funding comes mainly from a grant from Delta Dental. This is the second year for Delta Dental to provide financial assistance. Supplies have also been donated by area dentists and dental supply companies. All dentists, assistants, hygienists, students, and faculty donate their time. For more information, 479-788-7270.
Two Eagle Award recipients will be formally recognized during Washington Regional Foundation's 2014 Gala. It's scheduled for Tuesday, April 8th at Walton Arts Center. Established in 1994, the Eagle Award for Outstanding Health Leadership is given to individuals or organizations that make outstanding contributions to the improvement of healthcare in Northwest Arkansas. This year's recipients are Kathy Grisham and Faith in Action. Fayetteville became a bit less conversational in the last few days. Lyle Thompson, an agronomist and professor emeritus at the University of Arkansas, and John Logan Burrow, an attorney and the Washington County Election Commissioner, both died recently. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums knew both and has this remembrance.
Lyle Thompson was a polymath. He knew agriculture, of course, but that was his academic discipline. He was also apt to share a poem, a bit of history, or discuss the local news. Lyle was among the most vibrant proponents of civil rights in Northwest Arkansas decades ago, and he was honored for his efforts in that endeavor more than once. He was also well known for writing notes, actual letters congratulating friends and strangers on a task well done. In January 1991, Lyle Thompson and I went to the University of Arkansas farm on a bitterly cold day to look at an experimental crop of kanaf.
There was a plant that was kind of at the end of the row where it got more sunlight, some of these plants were at least 10 foot tall, 8 to 10 feet tall anyway.
It was a plant that had possibilities of replacing trees for some newsprint. The wind chills that day were below freezing, and I remember Lyle, then in his mid-60s, taking no notice of the wind or cold while I shivered.
The United States government got interested in it during the early years of World War II when we thought that our supplies of jute type of cordage and gunny sack type of material would be cut off from importation from Southeast Asia. And we started working on new varieties that would suit our climate, but before we got anything that was capable of being grown commercially while the war was over with.
After I toured the farm with Lyle on that day in early 1991 and turned off the cassette recorder, he asked me if he could, from time to time, send me some story ideas. Not just agricultural ideas, but anything he might think I find interesting. I said, of course, and thus began a more than 20-year series of notes, calls, and letters from Lyle. He didn't just teach and conduct research at the university. He served on the Washington County Quorum Court and was the officiant at many weddings, including mine, 6 years after we met at the university farm. The last time I talked to Lyle was at the Ozarks at Large Christmas show at the Fayetteville Public Library in December. About 20 minutes before our recording was to begin, I was beginning to worry nobody was going to show up for the audience. The hall was empty. Then Lyle walked in. He came over to me and with a wink said, "Hey, I think I was at your wedding." And he gave me a pat on the back. Suddenly, honestly, the audience began to flood in right behind him. Lyle Thompson then, as always, the harbinger of good things to come. As passionate as Lyle was about learning and teaching, John Logan Burrow was committed to elections. John, a lawyer by trade, was appointed to the Washington County Election Commission in 1984 and became commissioner in 1995. It's a thankless job. The election commissioner gets to hear from any citizen upset about polling places, polling times, polling locations, any other kind of election issue. John took it all with grace, interest, and respect. In November 2012, John Logan Burrow came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to Ozarks at Large about the next day's elections. He told us on that day that the elections of contemporary times had changed dramatically since he began his tenure on the Election Commission in the 1980s.
Well, it certainly is more complex for us to organize the election. We now have 56 polling places in Washington County on Election Day. We have 128 different precincts in Washington County, upwards of 50 or so different ballots for Washington County. We'll have 2,000 voters accredited at any given polling place. There's 102,000 registered voters in Washington County, and we have to technically be prepared for all 102,000 of them to show up to vote. So it's become more complex in this sense that it's not any longer just your neighborhood a gathering place where we can put in a polling place, because we have to be able to accommodate larger numbers of voters than your traditional polling place was 30 or 40 years ago. And so we're moving in a direction towards even larger voting centers so that larger numbers of people can come to a place that's suitable for a large number of people to be voting at, as opposed to smaller places with limited parking and interior spaces where the lines may stretch out the door into inclement weather. And so we're having to accommodate a growing voting population that does complicate our problem.
Elections seem to me to be like baseball, very traditional. with a set of Byzantine rules, and just when you think you've seen everything that could happen, boom, something else happens. There's some other situation that maybe has not happened ever before. Is that an apt analogy?
That's exactly right. It is a totally apt analogy. We just when we think we've seen it all, something comes along that we have to confront and cope with for the very first time in our lives.
Toward the end of that 2012 conversation, I asked John about the cynicism that could creep into the public mindset as an election draws near. His answer neatly sums up the positive outlook any voter would want in their county election commissioner. It's easy to be cynical in these times, as it has been at other times. People can say, I'm not going to vote. The candidates don't listen to me. They represent special interests and not me. But on election day, you have the chance to go to the ballot box. Here is your chance. What would you say to someone? Why vote?
I would remind them of times when people have come up to me in the days after an election and say they just could not ever get over the fact that for some reason they didn't go and vote, and it was a tie vote. If they had only showed up to vote, the thing would have gone the other way. Or it is a very, very narrow margin of decision. Two or three votes determine the outcome of an election. And they say to me, I can't believe I didn't go and vote that day. So it's in my experience, everybody that's out there that's trying to decide whether their vote's going to count or not really needs to remember it can come right down to your vote, how this election turns out. It is the system that we have that determines who will have power to make our decisions, to spend our money and make our laws. It is an extraordinarily important thing. It actually determines the legitimacy of the government itself, and you have to take that deeply seriously. It is the one thing that keeps us from having the terrible chaos and tragedy that other societies in the world take for granted that they're going to have to endure and pay the price for. We get to decide with our votes what the future of our politics is and our government is, and it may not be perfect. It may not be the thing that really satisfies people, but as Winston Churchill says, it's better than every other one.
John Logan Borough could talk about more than just elections. If you were walking around the Fayetteville Square or down Dixon Street, you were likely to see John and just as likely to hear him express his delight with the weather, his interest in aircraft, music, or something he had read or heard the previous day. And he'd want to know what you thought, too. Chances are you'd learn more from John than he'd learn from you. John Logan Borough and Lyle Thompson spent much of their lives making Fayetteville better and helping those who knew them learn more and laugh a lot more. They'll be missed greatly, and this place will not quite be the same. And a random walk on campus or downtown has lost a bit of its charm. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a previously unpublished story by Jack Kerouac pays tribute to friends killed in World War II.
I've come to see Kerouac's work as this epic cycle of memorialization.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host. But for now, as we end today's show, we're going to end it with some music by Little Chief, a local band. They released their new album, Lion's Den, on Monday. It's now available on iTunes. The song here is called Mountain Song, and you can see them tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at George's Majestic Lounge. They will be followed by Judah and the Lion. Tickets are $10, and you can find out more at littlechiefband.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great Wednesday.